Penguin Random House Audio presents The Balfour Declaration, The Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict by Jonathan Schneer. Read for you by Nicholas Guy Smith. In his indignation, Cadmus killed the dragon, and by the advice of Athena, sowed its teeth. When they were sown, there rose from the ground armed men. Apollodorus 3:41. Translated by J.G. Fraser. Postlude as Prelude. London on December 2nd, 1917. A cold, rainy, windy day. Gloomy weather to match British prospects in the stalemated Great War. The Italians had just met a disaster at Caporetto so complete that it seemed likely to take them out of combat altogether. The Russian Bolsheviks, who had seized power in Petrograd the month before, were preparing to negotiate their country's surrender to Germany. On the Western Front, the Entente and German forces continued to wreak havoc upon each other with neither end nor breakthrough in sight. But the Germans were gathering for another tremendous offensive, intending to win the war before American troops arrived in sufficient number to tip the balance against them. Somehow, Britain and France must summon the resolve and the resources to hang on. On Kingsway, near the Strand, despite the rain and wind and generally awful war news, a steady stream of beaming men and women poured into the London Opera House. They filled the tiers of boxes, the auditorium, the saloons, lounges, and foyers, even the corridors. The handsome structure, designed to hold 2,700, was filled to capacity and more. People waited outside in the street under their umbrellas. They would not leave. Inside, about a dozen men gathered near the stage. Among them were a former Liberal cabinet minister, Herbert Samuel, the assistant foreign secretary, Robert Cecil, an assistant secretary to the war cabinet, Sir Mark Sykes, the unofficial head of the British Jewish community, Lord Rothschild, and the two most important leaders of wartime British Zionism, Chaim Weizmann and Nahum Sokolow. They, and all the rest, beamed with pleasure. When finally the doors closed and the crowd settled, Lord Rothschild, hands in his pockets, spoke first to the breathless, happy audience. "We are met on the most momentous occasion in the history of Judaism for the last 1,800 years, he began. "We are here to return thanks to His Majesty's government for a declaration which marked an epoch. For the first time since the dispersion, the Jewish people have received their proper status by the declaration of one of the great powers." He referred, of course, to the Balfour Declaration, which the War Cabinet had agreed to 1 month earlier and published on November 9th. By this document, the British government pledged to use their best endeavours to establish in Palestine a national home for the Jewish people. One by one, the men on the stage advanced to speak. One by one, they offered thanks or congratulations and rosy predictions for the land to be freed at long last from the onerous Turkish yoke. Even an Arab spokesman, Sheikh Ismail Abdul al-Aki, foresaw the day when Palestine would again flow with milk and honey. Everyone said that the declaration represented a historic gesture on the part of Britain and a historic achievement on the part of Zionism, the culmination of a joint effort that must lead to Judea for the Jews, as Robert Cecil put it. And because the declaration also promised that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, they predicted that Jews and Arabs would share the land in harmony. That last prophecy proved wishful thinking, but events have largely borne out the rest. Today we consider the Balfour Declaration a great marker in Jewish history, not merely a Zionist victory, but a foundation stone of modern Israel. Some of us may know a bit about it. We may have read about the enormous effort, planning, and vision, as well as the unlikely alliances, prejudices, intrigues, and double-dealing that went into its making. Few, if any, however, can know that on the very day that the joyful throng gathered to celebrate at the London Opera House, Britain's Prime Minister and his agents were engaged in secret manoeuvrings to detach the Ottoman Empire from the Central Powers. They were offering, among other inducements, that the Turkish flag could continue to fly over Palestine. But the Zionists had long deemed Ottoman rule in Palestine to be one of their chief obstacles. Most of them viewed Turkish suzerainty, no matter how attenuated, as intolerable. Had the Turks accepted Lloyd George's offer, most Zionists, and certainly their most important leaders, would have felt that the British government had compromised, perhaps fatally, its recent pledge. In which case, no one today would pay much attention to the Balfour Declaration at all. Of those secret dealings, two, or possibly three men standing on the Opera House stage were well aware. They disapproved because they knew what the Zionist reaction would be, but they did not tell. Everyone else at the celebration remained in ignorance. That disparity of knowledge between government officials and the human objects of policy, and its potential for betrayal, encapsulates in a single moment the tortuous process that had led to the Balfour Declaration, and nearly to its swift negation. The meeting at the London Opera House on December 2nd crystallized a convoluted history that too often has been conceived as an irresistible forward march. This book will show that the lead-up to the Balfour Declaration was anything but a simple triumphal progress. And since intrigue and double-dealing, as much as bravery and vision, were of its essence, the Balfour Declaration resulted not merely in celebration and congratulation, but soon enough in disillusionment, distrust, and resentment. Nearly a century later, these bitter emotions remain. Compounded over the years, they continue tragically, bloodily, to unwind. Part 1. Sirocco. Chapter 1. Palestine before World War I. The land called Palestine gave no indication, early in the 20th century, that it would become the world's cockpit. Rather, if anything, the reverse. A century ago, it was merely a strip of territory running along the east coast of the Mediterranean Sea. The remote, sleepy, backward, sparsely populated southwestern bit of Syria was still home to foxes, jackals, hyenas, wildcats, wolves, even cheetahs and leopards in its most unsettled parts. Loosely governed from Jerusalem in the south and from Beirut in the north by agents of the Ottoman Empire, Palestine's borders were vague. To the east, it merged with the Jordanian plateau, to the south with the Arabian deserts, and to the north with the grey mountain masses of Lebanon. And it was small, fewer than 200 miles long and 50 miles wide. It was not much bigger than present-day Massachusetts, to put it in an American context, and about the size of Wales, to put it in the British. The strip of land, resting mainly upon limestone, was devoid of coal, iron, copper, silver, or gold deposits, and lacked oil, but it was happily porous. Calcareous, the geologist said, meaning that it was capable of absorbing moisture whenever the heavens should open, which they might do, especially when the wind came from the north. When it came from the east, however, as it frequently did in May and October, the wind was a malign enervating force. It was a furnace blast sirocco in hot weather and a numbing chill in cold. The two mountain ranges that ran in rough parallel the length of the country.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?